Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution sounds.
It's the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen. It's Thursday, January 10, 2013. And unfortunately, over time, we've lost some of our good buddies. Jake Towne took a new job last summer. And, of course, he hasn't been around too much lately. And Gene DiNardo's been trying to make it when he can. But his job has been kind of iffy, so sometimes he can make it, sometimes he can't. This time, unfortunately, he can't. And our newer buddy, Bill G, is also unavailable these days because he's getting ready to move to upstate New York. So we're bringing in new folks, trying out new folks and so forth. And we have another new one this week. Bill Westmiller is joining us. He's also a columnist at the Nolan Chart, but he also has quite a background of his own besides that, including a background in radio broadcast. So, Bill, welcome to the program.
Happy to be here. I don't know if I like being a last resort, but
you're not.
I'll pitch in any way I can.
Well, I don't know why I didn't think of you before, because I knew, of course, for a number of years now that you have the radio broadcast background. What took me so long? I honestly couldn't tell you, but I'm glad I finally thought of you.
Well, I have to admit, I have. With some reluctance, abandoned a lot of my writing and also abandoned a lot of my political activities, because I have burning wish in my heart to write a book on physics.
Really?
Yes.
I didn't know about that. Tell me about that.
Well, I've been, you know, a science student. I was majored in physics, minored in calculus. Never got a degree because none of the professors could ever answer the question, why? It was always memorize the formula, here's where it applies, don't worry about what it means, don't worry about how it works, don't, you know, just ignore all that stuff and memorize it and you'll be fine. Well, I wanted the answer, so I started reading all kinds of, you know, physics textbooks and some of the famous documents from various experiments and developed my own theory.
So where do you focus your attention? Are you like a quantum mechanics guy, or do you have interest with biophysics, or what's your area?
It's in the area of quantum physics.
Quantum physics, okay.
Yeah.
Very
yes.
Good. We'll have to have an offline conversation about that, because I have a little dabbling interest in it, too.
Sure.
But anyway, let's look at the headlines. We're going to be talking about a number of things this week. LIBOR is back in the news a little bit. We'll have a little touch up on that. And Europe, everybody is now saying that Europe is healing up just fine. In fact, a lot of news reports out today, but maybe not so fast. Of course, we here at the Freedom News Hour for quite some time have been reporting what was going on there long before the major media were catching up to it. And today we're going to have one more piece of information that will basically put the idea in your head that, no, this one isn't quite over with it yet either. In the aftermath of the horror at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, there is a story coming out of Ohio about teachers who actually want to take a firearms training. We're going to take a look at that one. There's also a new CFPB ruling about qualification of mortgages, and we'll talk about that as well. We're also going to take a look at what's going on once again in the European Union with their unemployment rate. That's something we don't look at too much. Most of America doesn't look at too much, and yet things are kind of advancing there in a way that the media are, again, not paying attention to. Once again, very much in line with what we've reported for the last 3 years about the nature of the monetary system and what really happens in the background. And Bill's also bringing a story that he's been working on, not just a story, it's actually a project he's been working on for quite some time. He's going to get us up to date on the latest with efforts to put in a balanced budget amendment. So we'll look at that too. But let's start the program off with a little piece of news that's coming out of Europe. This is Moody's Investment Service. They're announcing today, Thursday, that they have slashed Cyprus's rating 3 notches on an expected rise in the Mediterranean country's debt burden, and they've warned it could cut the rating again. They cut the rating to CAA3 from B3. That is virtually junk bond status. Quote, the key driver of today's rating action is the anticipated rise in the Cypriot government's debt burden, driven principally by the increased recapitalization needs of its banking system following distressed exchanges on Greek government debt and rising delinquencies on loans to Greek and Cypriot obligors. That's what Moody's said in a statement. Now, what does that all translate to? Well, what it translates to is, despite everything they've been telling us, and of course we've taken issue with that every step of the way here on this program, despite what they're telling us every step of the way, the European financial crisis is not over. There are still lots of dominoes that can fall, and whenever we see one of the rating services knock down even one of the tiniest portions of the European Union, we say, yeah, we're not quite done yet. Bill, I don't know, have you followed what's going on with the European crisis at all?
Well, as much as anybody has in the news, it's the acronym I always remember is PIGS, which
yes.
is the list of the various countries that are in dire straits. And you know, we can talk about how things are developing, but basically they're just creating new bonds and new bank obligations and glossing over the problems because they haven't cut spending, they haven't done anything serious to eliminate the debt problems there. But what I find even more amusing is that the United States right now has a debt ratio to GDP which is just within a few notches of Greece.
Yeah, which
so
is an interesting.
If you think Greece has got problems, we're due for some too.
I guess the one thing we have that Greece doesn't have, at least for now, is that the dollar is one of the reserve currencies of the world.
Right.
And I don't know how long that status will last, but I guess that's what kind of gives us, a little extra lease on life before we hang ourselves.
Yeah, there isn't anything better
in
terms
right.
of reliability. The people around the world are have no choice but the dollar or the, to some degree, the euro, only because Germany is backing it.
But
if it gets soft with Germany, they're going to have all kinds of headaches.
And you also have the yen. I mean, the euro, the yen, and the dollar, those are basically the mainstays
right.
of the reserve currency.
Right.
And they're all engaged, of course, in a race to the bottom. So it's a fun time to be somebody who uses currency.
Well, you have to get into the bit currency.
You're not a Bitcoin guy, huh?
And, well, no, I'm not into it. I don't get it, quite frankly, but... It seems to be becoming something that's fairly popular in international trade.
I'm too much of a computer programmer. I just don't trust anything. That
Me too.
I know how easy it is to manipulate a database, and anyone
yeah.
who tells me otherwise, I know they're lying through their teeth.
Yeah, well, and, you know, governments are probably far more experienced at manipulating databases to make money look good.
That's right. They have long years of experience.
Exactly. So I don't know. It's interesting that there's a distinction in a lot of the stories between the EU itself, the European Union, and the euro as a monetary currency. The euro per se seems to be maintaining its value, at least relative to the dollar and the yen. While the European Union, because of all of the banking, you know, the fiscal problems, seems to be getting shakier and shakier every day. Even Germany and France are arguing about what should be done, and there are other countries talking about just getting out of it altogether.
Yeah, we've talked about it a lot here on the show. In fact, Jake, while he was involved a lot, was doing a lot of research on it. And the one pattern that comes up over and over again is that despite the fact that the European Union continues to monetize debt through the issuance of new bonds, they continue to decline to admit that they're doing this, and the marketplace also declines to admit that they're doing it, so therefore they're not doing it.
Yeah,
that's great logic, don't you think?
I mean, good logic, you know. It's, we're not torturing because Obama says we're not torturing.
That's right.
So we couldn't be doing it. It's not possible. You know, all of the people killed with drones are enemy combatants. How do we know that? Because Obama says so.
That's right. Well, it's right out of 1984, in a sense, because when Obama was elected, he was promising to close down Guantanamo. But now to hear the government tells it, well, they've always promised to keep Guantanamo open. Right out of 1984.
Well, I like the euphemisms. Obama's kill list for the drones is called a disposition matrix.
Ooh,
now that's,
I hadn't heard
that's
that
even
one.
Yeah, that's even beyond 1984 Animal Farm. That's very creative linguistics there.
Sometimes so if you have the wrong disposition, they put you in your matrix. Is that it?
Well, the kill list is a list, a database. you know, with this matrix of where the person is and how bad they are and whether they're in range of a drone and, you know, if they've been bumped off or not. That's a, it's a database system.
And of course, it's a system that works
keeps
well.
Track of all the bad guys.
Yeah. Yeah. Keeps killing them off, and we're making such progress, don't you think?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, and the thing you have to realize when we're talking about either Europe or the U.S., you know, fiscal policy, the debt is not a problem. I mean, all of them are Keynesian-based systems. That say that debt isn't a problem. I mean, it's just the amount you owe yourself. So what's the problem? You know,
oh,
we can spend as much as we want.
Yeah, they call it, they don't say this, but they think of debt as a solution.
Yeah, yeah.
Not a problem at all.
Yeah.
The only problem
is
actually based in real economics.
Even when Ron Paul was on the committee, Ben Bernanke would come in and say, we have to have this debt, otherwise what is the Fed going to do?
This is the same person who said that gold isn't money, so... Anyway, the LIBOR scandal continues to pop up despite every effort to keep it under the surface. A number of minor pieces of information came out this week, but there was one particularly interesting piece that came out of PBS, our favorite nonprofit radio network and television network. This is an article that you can actually find on their website. It's called "The LIBOR Scandal, Not That Big a Deal." I thought that was a fascinating title, so I took a look at it, and most of it is kind of what you'd expect from an article that PBS would put out there.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to read a couple of key paragraphs, and you'll have to kind of bear with me because I didn't really mark them out, so I'll have to kind of do it on the fly here. But
I'm reading the article, so make sure you're quoting them correctly.
Yeah, right. Well, this particular article quotes a guy named Doug DeShiel, who they describe as their man of the pits. And he says he thinks it's easy to make something of the LIBOR scandal that is not a conspiracy that screwed the global economy. Doug was the head of proprietary trading at J.P. Morgan until the merger with Chase, and then co-head thereafter. And they featured him quite prominently. Now, of course, as soon as we hear J.P. Morgan and we think to ourselves, what role do they have with the central banks? Because there's been all kinds of rumors of manipulation there. Well, he goes on to admit that there have been a wide range of manipulations. And then he makes a really interesting comment. Let's see if I can find it here. Oh, yeah. He says, routine examples of market manipulation are far too numerous to outline in an email. This is an email he sent to PBS. But is setting up for a treasury auction by dealers, market manipulation, or simply savvy risk management? The LIBOR scandal just happens to be one example of market manipulation by dealers that the regulators happened to stumble upon, and because LIBOR involves notional principal contracts, the scale seems enormous. However, there are many other cases of market manipulation in the securities market occurring daily, and I would argue that currently the largest market price manipulator in the fixed income markets today, ironically, is a regulator, the Federal Reserve. Most fixed income assets should be renamed price fixed and no income instead. Now, the last statement, of course, is kind of like a qualifier to modify his little attack there. But what an interesting comment for a top banker to say about the Fed.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's, the LIBOR thing, is really an odd problem. The Bank of England basically asked everybody to report what their average interest rate was. On a purely voluntary basis, and there was no validation, there was no checking, nobody went back and said, oh, you're wrong. And so, you know, there were banks that were doing, you know, deals with the LIBOR Commission saying, you know, I'll pay whatever I need to pay, but put this number at this point, and I'll make a lot of money. I'll pay you for it.
And that's what's basically been promoted in the news. I've actually expressed the opinion on this show a number of times that doesn't totally explain what happened, because what we know is that the LIBOR rate was basically manipulated downward. And the question that I ask myself as I consider that fact is, who besides some rogue traders would benefit from that? And the answer that comes to me inescapably is the central bankers, because it's in the central bankers' interest to keep those rates as low as possible. That's how they tried to make us pretend that we somehow skated past the crisis, that and creating a whole bunch of money out of thin air. The combination is how we keep those adjustable rate mortgages from going out of control and having a whole bunch of people default on their mortgages, combined with flooding the economy with a whole bunch of money, which has not totally made it into the economy yet, but nevertheless, that's the attempt. And that combination is supposed to save the world. So it strikes me that, wow, I would think there'd be an extremely strong motive for central bankers to be involved on the side of the manipulators in the LIBOR scandal.
Oh, of course. Well, as well as the governments. I mean, the governments want the rate to be as low as possible because they don't want people to discover that there's inflation going on. You know, they don't want people to see the results of what they're doing with their currency manipulation.
That's right. Absolutely. Even in countries like the U.S. and the European Union that are relatively open on these things, I mean, most central banks around the world, they just, you know, you don't know what they're doing. They just don't publish anything. It's only some of the Western countries that are stupid.
Well, I was interested. The NPR article quoted some emails from one banker. I will effing do one humongous deal with you, like a $50,000 deal, whatever you want. Just keep that rate as low as possible. If you know, $50,000, $100,000, whatever you want, I'm a man of my word.
Right.
Now, what you will never read is what the regulators or the government, treasuries said to those central bankers. You will never hear that.
Right.
Because that's top secret. That's national security.
Yeah, pretty much it is. And that's not the truth.
Yeah.
We every once in a while, we like to, Jake and Gene and I like to pick these little tidbits out of the news whenever we spot them because
sure.
It's like, one little, they lifted up the curtain a little bit too far, that kind of a thing.
Well, I'm waiting for WikiLeaks to dump its million documents. Hopefully there'll be some banking documents in there, too.
Gee, we've been waiting for that for what? A year?
He's got to make some threats so that people are a little spooked about, kidnapping him from the embassy and taking him to Sweden. I'm going to end up in Guantanamo.
I don't know. I think they've gotten him out of there, so I don't know. Oh, well. Hey, at least you're getting into the swing of things here. We have a lot of fun with this craziness, and that's good.
Sure.
Meanwhile, let's see, we're about a quarter of the way through. This is about the time I wanted to bring in your pet subject, and we can pick up some of the headlines afterward. You've been really spending a lot of time lately, I know, looking into this concept of a balanced budget amendment. And I know you came up with some new tidbits this week, but why don't you first outline for listeners, because most listeners probably don't know much about it. They probably understand the basic concept, but, why is anybody ever paying attention to this kind of thing, that sort of thing. And then also, what have you done lately?
Yeah, I mean, the bottom line is that people recognize that Congress is not willing to reduce the budget or reduce its spending, and therefore the proposition is that the states will initiate a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution that will require them to do that. It will set a limit that can't be modified by Congress that they have to stick with, and they've got no choice. Now, the balanced budget idea has been around since the 60s or so, was when states first started recognizing that Congress wasn't going to pass anything, and so they started submitting, the state legislature started submitting resolutions and requests and petitions to the federal government in order to qualify a amending convention that would do it independent of Congress entirely. And in fact, over the course of the past couple of decades, they were able to accumulate, I think, as many as 34 states that requested a convention in order to consider a balanced budget amendment. Now, because some of them are old and some of them expired, the number isn't quite there yet. But a lot of people got scared because they were thinking of this as a constitutional convention, in other words, one that would have total latitude for modifying any provision in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. So that put a dent in things. Graham Rudman put a dent in things because Congress did actually adopt a balanced budget, proposal, Graham Rudman, that had various, restraints on spending. That disappeared about 5 years ago. And so the whole issue of getting a balanced budget amendment passed either through Congress or through the state legislatures has resurfaced with some enthusiasm and some vigor. The most recent one is a Compact for America, and you can visit their website. Just do a Google for Compact for America. And what they've done is they've written a balanced budget amendment that covers all the bases. But more important, they put it into a package that state legislators can adopt that is a resolution that essentially forms a compact between the various states as to how the convention is going to be conducted. Specifically, it precludes considering any other subject except for a balanced budget amendment. It has various provisions for where the convention is going to be held, how the delegates are going to be selected, how they can vote, and so on and so forth. So they put together a very comprehensive, and by they, I mean probably a dozen different people from fairly major organizations, the Goldwater Institute, Institute for Justice, a number of corporate, legal, academic, even some media names like John McLaughlin of the McLaughlin Group. And they've gotten together, and they're in the process of pushing this. And the Republican Liberty Caucus, of which I'm still a board alternate, yesterday unanimously endorsed their proposed amendment. So things are moving forward. It looks like they've got a fair amount of money to get things rolling. They've got the contacts they need in the various states and are using the resources of a variety of different organizations that have been pushing for a balanced budget amendment for quite some time. So I'm pretty optimistic that this is going to get off the ground, and if they do it quickly enough, get the bandwagon going fast enough, it'll scare Congress, and they won't start filing lawsuits against it and trying to preempt it with a congressional version that has all kinds of loopholes and exceptions and, you know, waffly this and waffly that.
I'm looking forward to
an interesting development over the next 6 months or so, see how it progresses.
I'm skeptical, though. I mean, we've heard about this kind of thing for quite some time, and I also share some of the reservations that you raised. But the biggest skepticism I have is, I mean, how much legs does this really have? Because it's not something that's getting a whole lot of attention in the media, and that's usually where stuff kind of incubates, if you will, before it takes off. So I mean, what reason do we have to believe that this is actually going to be a serious thing?
Well, they just completed their website. If you go to the website, they've now got all of their documents and documentation and reference lists, and the whole shebang is on there. So they haven't done anything public yet. As a matter of fact, the RLC is kind of withholding at their discretion our press release on the idea because they want to do it as a media bump, but they want to do it after they've got a significant number of state legislators, if not, you know, states actually adopting their proposal. So they're holding it off for another month or two before they do a media splash. Now, the fact they've got people like John McLaughlin and a couple of other advisors with good media exposure suggests that they at least have some inside contacts to the media that's going to play into their hands. When I looked at it, the biggest problem I had was they drafted this compact, which is an agreement among the states about how the convention's going to be conducted. Article 1, Section 10, Clause 3 of the Constitution forbids any kind of a compact among the states without the permission of Congress.
I was just going to wonder about that, so I'm glad you raised that.
Well, that was, it's
completely unenforceable.
Well, let me put it this way. There are a lot of very smart lawyers who have looked at this thing, and they've written it in such a way that they think they can get away with having people sign it state legislators adopt it without its going into any effect until they have the 34 states, the three quarters, is required to adopt the amendment. And then they can go to Congress and say, hey, here's 38 states, I guess it is. Here's 38 states that have, you know, passed this thing, and, you know, in your mail today, you're going to get all 38 state petitions for exactly the same amendment, and we've got this compact, and we want you to approve it. And so it's a steamroller approach.
Yeah, you're basically suggesting that these lawyers believe that they can get everybody to kind of overlook the fact that that compact doesn't really accomplish anything.
Well, what they just put a clause in there just says it's not effective, that it has no legal standing until 38 states adopt it. Now, whether that gets, you know, these guys are not stupid guys. I mean, these are people who have argued in front of the Supreme Court and, you know.
But I'm also thinking, I mean, I may not like most of the people who are in politics or in Congress, but I have to admit, most of them aren't stupid guys either. It's not like they're going to have a hard time, especially their staff are going to have a hard time reading right through this thing.
Well, the question is, what can they do about it? I mean, the only injured party, so to speak, is the Congress, and the Congress doesn't normally file court challenges to enforce the constitutional provisions. So it's highly unlikely. I had a frog in my throat. Just like,
the time of year for this kind of thing, that's for sure.
So it's highly unlikely that the Congress is going to do that. So it depends upon basically the Attorney General filing a Supreme Court case saying these are all invalid. But the argument is, well, what do you mean invalid? They have no effect. There is no legal effect until they hit the 38. So all they're doing is just an agreement among themselves that doesn't affect any federal law or any federal rights and doesn't violate the Constitution until it actually goes into effect and governs the amending convention.
Well, it's not just the U.S. attorney who could file a suit. It could also be any of the attorneys general for any of the other states, including the ones who don't pass it. So there are a large number of parties that could actually bring suit here.
Yeah. No, and I discussed this at some length with the director and the chairman of the organization, and I said, you know, I think this is going to encounter all kinds of barriers, both judicially and politically.
Yeah, I agree.
But it's the only viable option out there. There's 65 to 70% in the polls of voters agree that there should be one. There have been dozens of different versions that have been introduced in Congress that never got out of committee. What's the alternative? There is no alternative.
I have to admit, though, I have another concern, and it's a concern that really doesn't get discussed at all. But my concern is that, really, even if we have something like this, let's assume, you know, best of all possible worlds, right? Assuming that you do believe that restricting congressional spending is the best of all possible worlds, and indeed there are many people who don't think that's true. But let's assume for the sake of discussion that it's the best of all possible worlds, that you can get an amendment in there, that you can stop spending from happening until a particular level, and that level is based on whether or not the budget that is made by Congress is a balanced budget. Okay. What does that do, first of all, to actually stop increases in spending? And I answer myself, well, doesn't do anything at all. All they have to do is put the balance so-called in budget. The budget is so-called in balance. Boy, I just can't get those words in the right order today, no matter what I do. but the second thing, and this is the only one that really I think is the killer, is it does absolutely nothing to address the nature of the monetary system, which is an expansionary money supply. And as long as that money supply is expansionary, all they have to do is play little games like they do with, say, Social Security, taking stuff off budget and so forth, and they can just, you know, spend to their heart's content. So I don't, even if you have it in place, I don't really see how it actually accomplishes anything as long as we have an expansionary monetary system. What do you think?
Here's how they get around that. Rather than saying like a percentage of GDP is the criteria for how much the the debt can be. They set a hard number. They say, upon adoption of this amendment, the total amount of debt that the U.S. can incur is 105% of the existing debt. And the only way that the debt ceiling can be increased is with the approval of a majority of the state legislatures. Now, because it's a hard number, if they inflate the currency, they're actually increasing the restrictions on themselves, because that dollar is no longer worth the whole dollar that they wanted. So the hard number being fixed in the amendment has its own inflation discouragement. And if the monetary value of the dollar is inflated, then the limit doesn't go up. In other words, there's no CPI on the limit.
Well, we're halfway through the show. We normally take a break here, so let's take a break, and then after the break, let's pick up this discussion some more, because I think there are some more points that we need to go over here.
Sure.
This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back. Yeah, run back. Turn up your dial. We're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. And just a reminder, you can always check out what's going on with upcoming shows when I do update the website. I have to admit I haven't done it in a while. But you can check it out at www.freedomnewshour.com. And I promise, this week I will update it. It will be up to date. You'll be able to check out everything, including some past broadcasts. And you can also find out broadcasts from the past by checking out the archives at prn.fm. Now, before the break, we were talking a little bit about the balanced budget amendment, the idea that's been floating to the surface again. And, Bill, you were mentioning the ways that they try to put a cap on how much spending can increase and how much debt can be incurred each year. The first question that comes to my mind is one that I touched on before the break, and that is Congress has many times in the past, often routinely, taken certain items off budget for a variety of reasons, given anything from national security to emergency situations to what have you, including items like, you know, Social Security. So the first question I have to ask is, how does this balanced budget amendment prevent that from happening?
Well, it has an entire section that defines terms. It explains that the debt is anything that's backed by the full faith and credit of the government of the United States. So anything that constitutes a real, you know, obligation is a debt. And then the total outlays defines all the different terminology. So they can play whatever games they want, but when the bottom line comes out, the expenditures cannot exceed the income by more than the current amount. Or it cannot exceed the income, period, covering all federal government income and all federal government all outgo. So it's they tried to cover all the bases. In terms of enforcement, granted, I mean, even if you got this amendment, there are all kinds of games that can be played. One of the provisions requires the president to publicly issue an impoundment list when the outstanding debt exceeds 98% of the limit. And those impoundments immediately go into effect unless Congress, within 30 days, replaces them with something else. Now, the amendment specifically says the failure of the president to designate or enforce the required impoundment is an impeachable misdemeanor. Now, it doesn't mean that the, you know, president doesn't do it is going to be impeached. It just means that it's grounds for bringing an impeachment clause. But, you know, no matter what words you write, somebody will find a way to misinterpret them.
Over the last few years particularly, we've seen numerous ways that the government has basically ignored large portions of not only the Constitution, but the Bill of Rights portion of the Constitution. So I guess the question in my mind is, unless it serves the purpose of whoever's doing the governing, why should we even think that this is going to get enforced?
Well, here's the potential, possible recourse. and that is because of the provision requiring a majority of the states to approve any increase in the debt, they are automatically valid parties to a lawsuit. So any state attorney general could file a lawsuit saying, you guys have violated this thing, you haven't asked our permission. So that's another means of enforcing it, even, no matter how they pretend that it's otherwise. So any one of the states is automatically, because of the way the amendment is written, is ripe for bringing a lawsuit as soon as the debt exceeds the amount that's authorized.
It strikes me that all that really does is increase litigiousness. I mean, the litigiousness is how a lot of stuff doesn't actually get done. But
it just puts a hammer over their head. Say, don't play games. I mean, it's whether or not any attorney general or any state is going to file a lawsuit is a totally separate issue, a discretion of the states.
And whether or not that lawsuit is actually going to get anywhere.
There's no problem.
But it's also a question of whether or not that lawsuit actually gains any legs in the court system. I mean, there's a lot of things that can fall apart here.
Well, yeah. I mean, there are all kinds of, provisions in the law and deference to the legislature and by the Supreme Court and every other court. But the deference does not normally... I say normally because there are exceptions, does not normally extend to violating the Constitution blatantly. In other words, if it's fairly obvious that the government is spending more than it takes in, that's a fact of the matter that isn't in dispute. So all of those kind of cases where a state attorney general would bring it in, it would be a prima facie case.
I think that's actually where the major dispute is going to come into it. I mean, for instance, you say, well, it's covered because even if they take stuff off budget, no matter what games they play, all what it comes down to, it still has to all add up to a particular number. Well, even with what they do now, they still can't make stuff add up to a single number. I mean, you look from practically from day to day, and you end up with different ideas of how much spending is going on within the U.S. government. So trying to pin down what the actual number is going to be nearly impossible.
Well, let me clarify something. This, technically speaking, this is not a balanced budget amendment. This is a debt limit amendment. In other words, no matter what they pass for a budget, it doesn't matter. What they say they're going to spend doesn't matter. It's all a matter of adding up the totals at the end of the day, whichever day it happens to be, and saying, today, the U.S. government spent more than it took in.
But that's what I'm saying, though. There are usually discrepancies and disputes as to how much is being spent.
No, you can go back. For example, there's a common fable about Bill Clinton having balanced the budget. But if you go back and look at the numbers of what the outlays were and what the income was year by year by year, there were no years in which, during Clinton's administration, in which the income exceeded the outgo. He had a deficit every year.
On budget. On budget.
No. This is CBO and the other agencies that do these counting do estimates, for the budget purposes. But they also do calculations of what has actually occurred. So not only do they, review what the intent of the legislature is and what the possible consequences are, they actually add up the total amounts. And so
right.
they
and
know
the
at the end of the year.
Often the thing is that the dispute never actually goes anywhere because it usually has no real strength. It's more just a talking point than anything else. But
it's a political talking point. But if there's an amendment that says, hey, when you add up all the total income outgo, according to the definition of this amendment, which is perfectly legitimate for any economist that can add up numbers, then you have grounds for a challenge.
And that's when I think that the questions raised about the accuracy of the numbers that, that say a CBO comes up with starts becoming a major issue. You know, how accurate are those numbers? Well, they're not accurate at all. Congressman so-and-so
well,
says
but
such
no,
and
well, the CBO, so-and-so no. The CBO can estimate it, but the Treasury is obligated by law to report on a quarterly basis exactly how many dollars came in and how many dollars went out every quarter. That's a requirement
it sounds
in law.
Paper. No, it sounds lovely on paper. I just, from having watched what Congress, the bureaucracy, the executive have done over the years, I just have absolutely no doubt in my mind is that the moment that this goes into effect, there's going to be yelling and screaming all over the place about this number's inaccurate and that number's inaccurate, and there you have a basis for a lawsuit.
Well, see, it doesn't become a dispute until the debt actually increases beyond this 105% of what's in effect at the time it goes in and it's adopted and confirmed. I mean, there is no amendment that is perfect. I mean, even the Second Amendment, you know, do you have a right to keep and bear arms? Well, for decades and decades, the conclusion was no. And until the Supreme Court decided, well, yeah, I guess there is an individual right involved there, it didn't exist.
And then to make it fun, there are even more people now who are saying, well, you know, the Constitution is antiquated. We should be, you know, bypassing the whole thing anyways.
Oh, yeah, of course. They do that all the time. And one of the I don't know if it would have to be an amendment to the Constitution. I guess it would. Is that there ought to be a provision in the Constitution that says any citizen has standing and has a claim in a court when any provision of the Constitution is violated, so that anybody can bring a case against the government anytime they want to, saying you aren't defending my Second Amendment rights and I'm injured as a consequence, and that would go to the Supreme Court.
If it got there,
that's not likely to happen soon. I've granted them the assumption that they know what they're doing legally, and they know what they're doing financially. But they also, you know, are willing to grant to me that there are going to be all kinds of problems, and that there are going to be very strong opposition, and there's going to be, you know, lawsuits filed left and right as this thing progresses. But both of us agree that it's something that needs to be done, and there is no alternative. Congress is not willing to do it.
We'll have to pay attention to that and see if it actually does gain legs.
Your listeners, it's compactforamerica.org.
All right.
And all the info.
You know, you mentioned the Second Amendment. That ties in another article that was on the list here. I wanted to go to that
one. Go for it. It's called a segue.
Segways, love them. This actually comes from WFMJ in Ohio, in Delaware, Ohio. I'll read a piece of it because it'll give you an idea of what it's about. It says, the idea of arming teachers to deal with school shooters has some willing volunteers, according to Ohio's Buckeye Firearms Foundation. Now, of course, we're on PRN. There's going to be a lot of people who are pro-gun control who are basically shrieking at the radio right now, and I understand, but just, you know, hear it out. It's an interesting story. You want to understand the story. It says, Jim Irvine, president of the Buckeye Firearms Foundation, says the response by teachers and others in the school system has been positive, with more than 600 across the state of Ohio applying for free training to carry a firearm into the school and classroom. He says it's not just teachers, it's administrators, principals, superintendents, office staff, guidance counselors, maintenance folks, food service people, and transportation people who are applying for this. And this is something that is not going to be handled by the school districts directly. This is people who are volunteering to do it on their own time. So what we're actually seeing here is sort of a counter groundswell, if you will, of people who are directly involved in schools saying, hey, we're tired of being defenseless and we want to do something about it. Very interesting. It's not something that gets a lot of attention in the major media, of course, but when something like that pops up, it just kind of grabs my attention and says, well, there really are two sides of this story.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was going to do some research and didn't get around to it, but there's talk about repealing the gun-free school zone legislation. But I recall from a couple of years back, I thought the Supreme Court had already ruled that the federal requirement that you couldn't carry a gun within 1,000 feet of the school was unconstitutionally, you know, broad.
Yeah, I'm not sure I know what that ruling was, one way or the other.
If I recall correctly, the federal legislation allows states to designate people who are allowed to carry arms on a school grounds.
Mm-hmm.
So that, for example, you can have, if state law allows it, you can have an armed guard at the door. But the issue is whether or not there are any states that, I think there are one or two, that allow someone who has just a generic concealed carry permit, who is also a teacher or administrator or whatever, works at the school, to be allowed to carry a concealed weapon at that school. And I think that, I have to laugh because I just watched the Piers Morgan interview with Larry Pratt, the Gun Owners of America, and he was basically saying the same thing, is a gun-free zone is a killing zone, and we need to allow people who have licenses to carry at school. And that's the way to defend people against these crazies, which I agree with.
Yeah, it's one of those sad but necessary truths that people aren't willing to face up to, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
I actually used to live near Newtown, Connecticut. I lived both in Monroe, Connecticut, which is just to the south, and that's the town where they have an old elementary school that's now being used in place of the old Sandy Hook School. It used to be called the Chalk Hill Elementary School. And then I also lived in Naugatuck, which is about 20 miles to the east of Sandy Hook, Newtown. And so I know the area fairly well. I know the kind of people who live in that area. It's a relatively conservative section of the state. Connecticut, of course, is a blue state, but it's a blue state in certain areas and not in other areas. It has very strong gun control laws in place, but that particular section of the state is more reddish than bluish, if you understand what I mean.
Yeah.
Now, it's really not an appropriate time. They're still in, you know, deep trauma from what happened. But I kind of wonder if somebody decides to pull that area in, say, you know, a year, 2 years, 3 years, something like that, I wonder what kind of reading we would get from the people who are involved in the schools in that local area on this kind of an issue. Because I just have this feeling that it would probably surprise a lot of gun control advocates what the beliefs would be. Mm-hmm. I don't know that for sure. I'm speculating, but that's my opinion based on having lived in that area for quite some time.
Yeah. Well, the thing that there's two things that irritate me, aside from the fact that these kids got killed, which
is
irritates me.
Oh, more than irritating,
but
I think it's horrendous.
Yes, yes, it's horrific. The first thing is that Connecticut has some of the strongest gun legislation in the whole nation.
They do,
And none of their laws were broken.
Well, actually, a couple laws were broken. One law was the concealed carry.
The shooter stole the guns from his mother.
Yeah, that was one. And he didn't have the permit to carry the gun. That was another one.
Right.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is that those laws did not prevent it from happening.
Right.
The second thing is, what is with the Newtown Police Department or the Connecticut Police Department that they are not disclosing exactly what transpired? Everybody knows who did the shootings. Everybody knows he's dead. Everybody knows basically the general thing. But we yet still don't know what guns he used. Now, initial reports were that it was a rifle that was looked something like an AR-15. But there are other reports that were on, like, NBC News saying, no, he left the rifle in the car. He had four handguns.
Believe it or not, that's actually fairly consistent for Connecticut, and not just Newtown, but for the state as a whole. It's very common for law enforcement in that state to withhold key information for long periods of time. And I don't know what the rationale is. I don't know what the reasoning is. But
if they had a suspect who was at large, or if they suspected there was somebody else involved, or they were, you know, doing grand jury testimony to indict someone, it would make sense. But it just makes no sense that there's no information whatsoever coming out from the police department. It just went dead after a week.
There's probably something in Connecticut law. I can't say I've studied Connecticut law that carefully to know what it is, but I'll bet you there's something in there or something perhaps in case law that has led all of the police departments to tread very, very slowly when it comes to releasing any data of this kind. I can only tell you this is very common. I mean, I recall, for instance, the numerous times where nearby the city of Waterbury, which is near Naugatuck, where I used to live, numerous mayors there had been indicted over the years and been convicted of all kinds of stuff. There was even a guy who came out of that area who became a governor. His name was John Rowland. He was convicted of stuff, too. I mean, just all kinds of stuff. And yet in each one of those cases, and those are just political cases, each one of those cases, key pieces of information were withheld for long periods of time, years at times. Yeah. Very, very common within Connecticut legal jurisprudence for that to happen. So it doesn't surprise me. You're right. It's rather disturbing that that happens, but I can't honestly say it surprises me. It's very consistent. Well, we've got about 3 minutes.
Frustrating.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Do you want to comment one more?
No, I just say it's frustrating because the original, you know, reports that the police gave are basically the fodder for all of the arguments against in favor of more gun control. And they're all talking about assault weapons and rifles and this sort of thing. We don't know that he used a rifle.
Yep. That's
so
true.
It's just irritating. I'm irritated.
Well, also, one of the, we've got 3 minutes left. I got two articles, and I don't really have time to do both of them, so I'm just going to do quick touches on them. First, I mentioned earlier in the show that the European Union is experiencing new high levels in overall unemployment rate. They've currently reached a level of 11.8%. That's a seasonally adjusted rate as of November 2012, up from 11.7% in November. The EU 27 unemployment rate was 10.7% in November 12. Basically, what all this is saying is that overall unemployment rate is not decreasing like many people had thought was happening. There are some signs of decrease according to the way they measure unemployment in this country, although even that is suspect because they massage the numbers so much. But despite all the massage going on in the European Union, the numbers are not going down. They're going up, and there are some particularly high numbers, particularly the PIGS countries as a main focus, that shows that not only is the financial crisis not over from the point of view of what's happening with Moody's ratings and so forth, but it's also continuing to create havoc within the economy. So just a
moral shock.
Sure you are. Just totally devastating. But I didn't want to touch on that one before we left. Also, one other story. This is, again, another one that's not terribly surprising, but the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau announced on Thursday today that they were putting in new lending rules. Basically, the long and the short of it is they put in rules that say that you can't do the kind of lending that was done with the subprime mortgages where people just take on a loan without having to show any documentation. And the obvious retort to that is, well, yeah, there were actually principles in place before that within the industry, then they got ignored. So is this going to be ignored again? And, well,
but what they did not mention at all was all of these no-doc and low-doc and all those other crazy loans were backed by Fannie and Freddie Mac with a government guarantee. The problem was a government guarantee. If those were private corporations, it wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, they wouldn't have made
so now they're coming on the private corporations saying, oh, you can't do that anymore because Fannie and Freddie are going broke and we have to pay for it.
And I'm no fan of the corporations, but in this case I have to say, well, wait a minute, let's point fingers where they deserve to be pointed.
Exactly.
And unfortunately, we've reached the end of our time. Boo-hoo. But, Bill, it's been great. You've been doing a great job as a fill-in here. Maybe we can coax you into staying on a more permanent basis, maybe?
I can be bribed.
You can be bribed? Oh, good. Well, then, we'll invite you back next week. We'll invite you back next week as well here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.